This is the night. I get goosebumps every year with that refrain. The song itself might be well over 1,000 years old, but it speaks to us as if it were written afresh and anew for tonight. This is the night, my friends. It frames our worship today as something extra special, something both moored in history and yet completely outside of time. But what exactly is so special about this night? I certainly can't take credit for the question because it is not an original one. It's similar to what happens during the modern Jewish Passover Seder. Perhaps you have had the chance to experience one, and if not, I would recommend it. At the appropriate spot in the liturgy, the youngest child present asks this question: what makes this night different from all other nights? And our answer maybe isn't really that different from the one enacted in the Seder. We are binding ourselves to the thousands of generations that came before us as we remember God's acts of salvation throughout history. We do this by telling our sacred stories, stories that have a trajectory from darkness into light. Much as we moved from a small fire burning in the chill outside to the blazing light of all these candles. The stories take us from the dark, formless void before creation all the way to the sun rising over the empty tomb. The women in Luke's gospel leave behind the darkness of confusion and despair and witness the dazzling light that is resurrection. But we're not just studying the past as if we were archaeologists digging up some ancient relic. No, we tell these stories as if they were our own. As one writer puts it, that is what gives us our own story, our own origin, as well as an orientation to the world. It's the telling of old stories as if they were new realities, because you know what? They are. The texts may be ancient, but the grace we experience in them is fresh with each telling. We began by hearing that God made the universe out of nothing. God filled it with earth and sky, with plants and animals, and creation was indeed good. But it wasn't very good. At least not until God created the real masterpiece, us. God created us in God's very own image. And so tonight we proclaim, first of all, that we owe our entire existence to God. But we also know that we, the creatures, rebelled against our Creator. One could not deny that we are broken people who live in a fallen world. And that broke God's heart. I'm pretty sure I know what I would have done. I probably would have just wiped out all the stupid, rebellious people and started over again. But tonight, we remember that God didn't do that. God loved us even when we did nothing to earn it. God called Noah and saved him and his family and all the animals from destruction. And so God spared the world from the wrath that it so totally deserved. It's a pattern we might just see again. Then God called Abraham and Sarah to be the ancestors of Israel, a people chosen to show forth God's light in the world. They were a nation that was supposed to be an example to the world of what it's like to do things God's way. But they soon all fell into captivity in Egypt. But tonight, we remember that the story didn't end there either. God heard their cries and delivered them from oppression. God revealed himself to Moses and warned the Egyptians, but the Pharaoh wouldn't listen. probably because he didn't want to lose his slave labor. So God instructed Moses to prepare the people for the most drastic warning of all. He told them to mark their doorposts with the blood of a lamb. And then when the Lord struck down all the firstborn in Egypt, he spared the children of Israel. He passed them over, and Pharaoh let them leave. But we heard tonight that that deliverance was short-lived. For as soon as the Israelites had departed, Pharaoh had a change of heart and sent his soldiers after them. But God came through once again. The waters were parted to allow Israel to pass through, and then they returned, swallowing up the Egyptian horses and chariots. You would think that God's lessons would eventually sink in. You'd think that people would have learned obedience and dependence, but they didn't. We didn't. Time and time again, mankind has rebelled against God. Yet even in that rebellion, we still thirsted for God, still longed for justice and a future. The prophetic message was clear that God would act if we would but turn back to God. We faced up to our wickedness. We traded our insistence on having our own way, and instead were willing to live into God's plan. So once again, God did not give up on humanity. Israel was sent into captivity for their sins, but their hope was never taken away. As the old saying goes, the heart of the human problem is the problem of the human heart. And that defined not only Israel, but through them, all of us. God knew that and promised that they would be washed clean and given a heart instead for their Creator, for their God. I'm going to quote a noted Old Testament scholar here, primarily just because he retired not long ago from Wheaton College up the road, and partly because it's kind of funny. He wrote once that Yahweh will remove Israel's fossilized heart and replace it with a sensitive, fleshly organ. But it was to be way more than a transplant. It was meant to be a total transformation. And then we heard Ezekiel's vision of the dry bones. It's a metaphor for that nation of Israel in exile. Although the people were brittle and lifeless, God promised to breathe new life into them. The prophets promised a time when they would all come home and the people would all be gathered together by God. They would all be saved and restored to the fullness of their nature, which is the image of God. And this, perhaps, is where our similarity with the Passover Seder must come to an end. Because tonight, we remember also that God has fulfilled every single one of those promises. The plan hatched in eternity was put in motion when Jesus was born as a human baby some 2,000 years ago. It wasn't enough for Jesus to teach and heal, although he certainly did those things. You see, that wouldn't do anything about the problem of our brokenness. And so tonight, we remember that Jesus willingly went to the cross for us after being scorned and abused. He lived a sinless life, but he died as if he hadn't. That was the only way. If our story ended there, it would still be incredible. But my friends, God saved the best for last. Envision with me that first Easter morning. It was still dark, like this. The followers of Jesus had just seen their Messiah put to death. They'd watched as he was tortured, taunted, and killed. It went against everything they expected. Every dream they had for the future was gone. And so they were scared. They were scared of being persecuted themselves. And most of all, they were probably scared that they were wrong, wrong about Jesus all along? What if he was just crazy? How could we have put all of our hopes in this guy? How could God let us down like that? So it no doubt took a lot of courage for the women to go to the tomb to anoint the body of Jesus with spices. After all, how would they get the stone out of the way? What if there are still soldiers there guarding the tomb? And not to mention, they were probably still grieving. But they needed to prepare him for a proper burial, for that was their custom. We just heard what happened when they arrived. Two men were standing there by the empty tomb. And I'm sure it is no coincidence that that just happened to be exactly the number of witnesses required in court under Jewish law. The men, who are called angels in John's version of the story, told them just simply the most amazing thing they've ever heard. He is not here, but has risen. So more than anything else, we remember tonight that the tomb could not hold Jesus, that death did not get the final word, that evil did not get to triumph. Tonight is indeed about remembrance, but only in part, because it also holds together the past and the future like a hinge. It reminds us that the God who acted in the past also acts today and will act again to bring everything into completion, to make all creation right again. Just as we use old words to speak a new grace, to invite a fresh encounter for us with God, so also we will do the same thing with our actions. Our liturgy always joins together the word and the table, the stories and the meal. Now, we can assume that humans have been eating food roughly forever, but this is a different sort of thing. This is not about calories or nutrition. This is the bread and the cup that the Jewish Jesus would have known from religious rituals. This is the meal that he celebrated with his disciples, the meal that he shared with sinners and outcasts, the meal he instructed us to continue, and the meal which foreshadows his kingdom. Indeed, the meal which is his very presence here with us tonight. It is then for us our own movement from death into life, from darkness into the light of Christ. The very bread of life and the cup of salvation, making real what is already true, that they are holy gifts for a holy people. Before we get there, however, we will remind ourselves of our identity as that holy people. We will together renew our baptismal vows. Now, there are a lot of metaphors for baptism in the Bible. It's a new birth. It's a forgiveness of sins. It's dying and rising with Christ. It's being joined into Christ's body, the church. It's even been thought of as another crossing of the Red Sea, making our own escape from captivity. And it is indeed all of these things. But it's also not a singular event, even though it can only happen once. It's something that we have to live into more deeply every day. We have to continuously break it open and examine it to figure out what it means. So we have to remind ourselves periodically of what it is we promised to do. So tonight, we remember. We remember God's saving acts throughout history, but we also celebrate. We celebrate Christ's death and resurrection. We celebrate God's grace for us in the present, for it is no idle tale. It is our story. Hallelujah, indeed.